My name is Stephen Smith, and I am the executive director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And I wanted to thank everybody for joining our series. Let me just say, I had a little trouble hearing Courtney, so I don't know if everybody heard, but basically, shortly after this tragic event began to unfold in the Gulf of Mexico, our organization, which does work primarily in the Southeast United States, we can go ahead and start advancing the slides. I think we've got a slide that tells a little bit about SACE, but SACE does work in 5 southern states, Tennessee, North and South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. And we've historically been focused on how energy is produced and consumed with a historic emphasis on the electric utility sector, dealing with coal-fired power plants, dealing with nuclear power plants, dealing with promoting energy efficiency and renewables. We do some work with clean air around diesel emissions and trying to clean up the transportation fleet there. But we had not historically been majorly focused on the transportation sector, nor on offshore drilling. In about the last 24 months, we begin to get more and more involved looking at the offshore drilling, particularly coming out of the 2008 elections, where there was a lot of discussion about wanting to reopen offshore drilling along the outer continental shelf in the southeastern states of the United States and then also in the Gulf of Mexico. And we began to look more and more at the drilling situation. And tragically, shortly after the Obama administration opened up or came out with a new statement on drilling late in March, this tragic event happened. And it's really forced us to take a much harder look at what our organization would want to do and be aggressive on promoting alternatives to oil and how we can reduce oil consumption. And in so doing, we began to really look at how the debate is being framed in this country. It seems like, you know, you have 2 very bad choices, it appeared. One, you either remain heavily dependent, addicted, some people say, to oil coming from hostile nations, many of them in the Middle East, who don't have the U.S. long-term interest in mind and have obviously demonstrated a great deal of hostility. A lot of people think some of the funding that is funding some of the terrorist groups is coming from Middle East oil money. And then that's one hand. On the other hand, we could grow our own, quote-unquote, homegrown domestic sources of oil, but that led to more aggressive drilling in more sensitive environmental areas, including offshore, and even more specifically in greater depths offshore, many now exceeding, you know, thousands of feet of water. And as we know with the Deepwater Horizon accident, they're in approximately 5,000 feet of water. But there are also, you know, drilling going on in the Gulf of Mexico approaching 10,000 feet of water. So it's just we're getting in more and more risky situations. And so what we wanted to do with the Gulf Challenge was say, what is it really what would it really take to break that dichotomy, that Faustian bargain where we're either getting oil from hostile nations in the Middle East or we're going to have to be drilling offshore? And so we came up with this concept of the Gulf Challenge, where let's, you know, how much of the oil do we get from the Persian Gulf? How much of the oil do we get from the Gulf of Mexico? What would it take to actually reduce our consumption by that amount? Now, we're not naive. We know that oil is a fungible commodity that plays in the world market, but we do know that if the United States was to take a leadership position, and our analysis shows that it's roughly 9% from the Gulf of Mexico and roughly 13% or so from the Persian Gulf, if we were to reduce our consumption by between 20 and 25%, we think that that would take away the argument of do we need to get oil from the Middle East or do we need to get oil from the Gulf of Mexico. And so what we wanted to do was get the best and brightest out there, and we're not a huge organization. We don't have a tremendous amount of money, but we offered up the $10,000 prize and said, let's get the best thinkers together and see what we can do. And so that's what you're going to actually hear today is the first of 3. Dr. Jerry Brown is going to present his findings and his analysis and the plan that he submitted, and talk us through that for the next 25 or 30 minutes, and then we'll have some time to answer questions. So I'm going to let Dr. Brown introduce himself and give a little bit on background, a little bit about his specific strategy. I do want to emphasize, and again, Courtney mentioned this earlier, we are asking people to vote. Courtney will come back on the line towards the end of the call and give more specific. People who are interested in this, we're asking people to weigh in on it, and we're going to announce the winner on July 13th. So we wanted to give all the finalists an opportunity to present it through the webinar technology, and that's what we're going to do today. So, Dr. Brown, let me turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Smith. Dr. Smith, Courtney, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just fine. Thank you, Dr. Brown.
Okay, excellent. Well, Courtney, thank you kindly, Dr. Smith, for the introduction. I'd like to start off by expressing my appreciation to the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy for hosting this Gulf Challenge. And also, I think it addresses not only the challenge, but one of the really seminal issues of our time, and that's the need to shift away from fossil fuels to a clean energy future. And even in a broader context, to paraphrase Bucky Fuller, who gave us the concept of Spaceship Earth, the greatest challenge really that we face is to reindustrialize, is to re-engineer all of our industrial systems to bring them back into a sustainable balance with nature. I want to thank also all of you who took the time, are taking the time to listen into this webinar and for voting for the plan that you think is best for America for now and for future generations. Today, what I'd like to do is outline why the Prometheus plan is, in my view, the best plan for meeting the goals of the Gulf Challenge. As you may know, Prometheus was the Greek god who stole fire from Zeus, and he did that in order to benefit and to nurture humanity. Today, all of us who are concerned about this fragile planet must take courage from Prometheus and work to reclaim our energy future from the oil companies and the politicians who perpetuated this dependence and oil addiction for the past three decades. As you see here on the first slide, I'm a founding professor of Global and Sociocultural Studies at Florida International University in Miami. I started there back in 1972, when I was 10 years old. And I've been studying the energy issue since 1976, when I first met a solar scientist who shifted my paradigm entirely in 76, when he told me, to my astonishment, the world is running out of oil. And the good news is we will eventually be able to find replacements for fossil fuels and live in a world without oil. Next slide, please. Today in this webinar, I'm going to address the following topics. The Prometheus plan, which can save 5 million barrels of oil a day in 10 years. This is a major accomplishment, given that the U.S. will be using 21 million barrels of oil a day by 2020, and therefore 5 million barrels is a 24% savings. That's 21 million 42-gallon barrels of oil a day, 365 days a year. And according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration and their International Energy Outlook, their projections, right now the world is consuming about 86 million barrels of oil, and by 2020 it will consume 96 million barrels of oil a day. So this 5 million barrels, that's 5% of total world oil use. That's a very significant number. I want to talk about, given that we're in the middle of the largest recession since the Great Depression, the impact of clean energy on green jobs and its ability to create or save 2 million jobs, about a quarter of the 8 million jobs we've lost in this recession, especially in the auto, trucking, and agricultural industries. Next slide, please. Ever since Amory Lovins, the world's energy guru, laid out an alternative soft energy path for the United States in a seminal article all the way back in 1976, over three decades ago, we've had the knowledge and most of the technology needed to make this transition towards a renewable energy future. What's been lacking is the imagination and the political will. What's been lacking is the ability to break out of what Dr. Smith has called this false dichotomy between Persian Gulf oil or offshore drilling. Next slide, please. Fortunately, in this case, Imagine is not simply a John Lennon fantasy, but it's a viable possibility today and within our time. So in this afternoon, I invite you to imagine a world in which America has won freedom from both Persian Gulf oil and offshore drilling while creating millions of green jobs over the next decade. And I'm not saying simply on future offshore drilling as the current discussion over the ban that the Obama administration is considering and wants to impose for the six-month period. This is about all offshore drilling. And imagine a world in which America has marshaled the political will to overcome the energy climate change crises that threaten our economy, our environment, our national security. The good news is we can build that world today with proven current technology while reducing greenhouse gas emissions and pollution. And the good news is that in addressing the energy issue and responding to this Gulf challenge, we can also address climate change, whether or not the bill before the Senate finally does put a price on carbon and puts meaningful cap and trade position in place. It looks like the Obama administration is backtracking already under political pressure to just focus in on carbon emissions from electrical power generating units, which would be a severe limitation. Next slide, please. The Prometheus plan that I'm presenting here today is elaborated in great detail in Freedom from Mideast Oil, a 527-page book available at Amazon.com, which was published by the World Business Academy. I am the lead researcher and writer of this work, which I co-authored with Rinaldo Brutico, an international business leader, and Jim Cusimano, a PhD chemist and former director of research and development at Exxon. Jim's also a climate change expert. The book offers a roadmap for fighting global warming and ending America's dependence on foreign oil. It's one of the only books that simultaneously addresses the energy and climate crises. In it, you'll discover how business can profit today using renewable energy sources, why ethanol has a role as a transitional fuel towards an oil-free hydrogen economy, and how we can create millions of jobs strengthening our economy and enhancing national security starting today. The book has been endorsed by leading thinkers, economist Hazel Henderson, author and visionary Deepak Chopra, Titan Oil executive Paul Davis, and as this slide shows, by Emery Lovins, in my view, one of the world, if not the world's leading alternative energy expert, who said, the stimulating synthesis provides a roadmap for solving the oil and climate problems simultaneously. In this book, we asked a simple question. Can the U.S. win independence from Middle East, same as Persian Gulf oil, in 10 years? We used the criteria. It had to be current technology that was in mass commercialization now. It had to reduce greenhouse gases and, in general, no new taxes. And I'll show you later on why I say in general. And the answer to this was a resounding, yes, we can. Si se puede. Next slide, please. We're not alone in reaching this conclusion. In researching this book, I examined the blueprints for energy abundance put forth by many organizations that were addressing this problem, just as we have this Gulf challenge before us today. Public interest groups, think tanks, universities, bipartisan commissions, and I've listed many of them there. Some of the blueprints, like the NRDC's Securing America, are based on detailed year-to-year rolling auto stock analysis of how these technologies, oil-saving technologies, would be implemented and phased in to the auto stock over a decade period and what the resulting oil savings would be. But while most of these blueprints saw that we could save 2.5 to 3.2 million barrels of oil a day, the Prometheus plan saves 5 million barrels. And there's no magic to that. The reason is that while some concentrated on improving passenger vehicle fuel economy and others on doubling the efficiency of using oil and others on building the domestic biofuels industry, the Prometheus plan builds a synthesis maximizing the best of all strategies. It's also important to note that this is not the end. This is just the first step towards getting off of all imported oil by 2040 and by moving towards an economy that can flourish with no oil by the middle of the century. How's that for imagination, for shifting the paradigm, for laying the groundwork for the coming global energy revolution? Next slide. This is the key slide in terms of meeting the Gulf Challenge and of reducing oil use, which asks, could we reduce our oil use by 20% or more in 10 years? The data here is all from official U.S. Energy Information Administration annual energy outlook 210 projection, so it's the most current data available. I'd like to call your attention to the year 2020 slide and to look at our total oil use, which is 21 million barrels a day. The transportation sector uses 15 million barrels. That's 71%. The conclusion is, if we're going to reduce oil, we have to do it mainly in the transportation sector. As we look further down at the Clean Energy Gulf Challenge, we see that 1.4 million comes from Persian Gulf imports, and another 2.1 million comes from 3.5. So if I can show you how the Prometheus plan saves 5 million barrels of oil a day, we can meet the Gulf Challenge and have 1.5 million barrels a day in surplus. We can make a reduction of 24%. We can replace all Persian Gulf oil and offshore drilling. And I'd like you to keep this 3.5 number in mind, because we're going to come back to it in the next slide as we get into the specifics of the Prometheus plan. Next slide, please. To summarize, here's what the Prometheus plan will do. And when it comes to this surplus of 1.5 million barrels a day, 365 days a year, $75 a barrel, that's an additional saving of about $41 billion annually forever. One can get giddy thinking about what we can do with that. We could replace all Venezuelan oil as well, since the relationship between the United States and Hugo Chavez is quite rocky. Or we could invest in accelerating the development of the hydrogen fuel cell car, which can run on hydrogen extracted from H2O, water, very plentiful, through electrolysis powered by solar photovoltaic energy. The hydrogen fuel cell is not a part of the Prometheus plan. However, it is emerging and will be the computer chip of the energy revolution. Next slide, please. Courtney, how's my time going?
You are 12 minutes in.
Oh, great.
I'll notify you when you're at the 20-minute mark.
Great. This is, unfortunately, an image that we're all too familiar with. This is the Deepwater Horizon oil rig burning. This is the beginning of the BP oil spill. Obviously, this will not be part of our future if the Prometheus plan is adopted and successfully implemented. And hopefully this catastrophic spill provides what one writer has called a shining moment of clarity, showing everyone the true cost of our oil addiction and providing the catalyst to finally create a clean energy future on level with something like the Marshall Plan or the Apollo project that took us to the moon. Let's remember, it was earlier oil spills that have also spurred America into action. The Santa Barbara oil spill of 1969 by Union Oil of California, now Chevron, is often credited, along with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, with inspiring the modern environmental movement. But that was capped in 10 days after releasing 100,000 barrels of oil. Now, in face of this BP catastrophe, which makes Santa Barbara look like a puddle, this has shown us the limits of oil drilling technology and the failure of federal regulation. In fact, as the head of Exxon testified before Congress on the oil spill, our technology for exploring these deep wells has far outstripped our planning and technology for preventing accidents and, obviously, for handling them once they occur. Probably the political cartoon humorists get it best of oil, best of all. That's a tricky one to say. And I wish I had had these slides and could include them. This is a guy looking up, I'm going to tell you what's on these cartoons, a guy looking up at oil prices at a gas station, and the prices are listed. Gulf of Mexico, national security, the world's climate. And the guy's filling up his car and saying, I miss it when gas costs $2 a gallon. Another one is a guy standing next to a huge, huge SUV and saying, damn it, Obama, do something. And the last cartoon shows a whale beached, covered with oil on the shore, and two oil executives saying, I was wondering when this was going to wash up on shore. And on the whale, it says oil addiction. When we were finally going to come face to face with the real costs of our oil addiction. Next slide, please. The next slide. This is an overview of the Prometheus plan. It shows the savings achievable in 10 years in million barrels of oil a day in the right-hand column. I'm just going to mention this and then go into detail in the next slide. The first are vehicle fuel efficiencies, raising the efficiency in new light-duty vehicles, that's passenger vehicles and light trucks and vans, to 40 miles per gallon fleet-wide in 10 years. Accelerating oil efficiency in motor vehicles through fuel-efficient replacement tires and lower viscosity motor oils in all vehicles, and in heavy-duty, big-rig tractor trailers, 8,500 pounds to 3,300 pounds and above, all of the above incentives and efficiencies, plus auxiliary power units, which I'll get into. We can also increase oil efficiency beyond transportation a little bit in the aviation, industrial, and residential sectors, small but important savings, and we can expand the biofuels industry. And as Vinod Khosla has said, it's a trajectory that goes from corn to sugar starting now to cellulosic feedstocks replacing corn beginning in 2015, as well as biodiesel from vegetable feedstocks. Next slide, please. So here we are talking about the details of the vehicle fuel efficiency strategy. Basically, in the new light-duty vehicles coming online from now, by 3 to 4% annual increase, we're going to achieve a 40 mile per gallon fleet average by 2020 through vehicle load reduction, efficient engines, integrated starter generators, more improved transmissions. And what are some of the specifics of these things? Well, vehicle load reduction, aerodynamic improvements, rolling resistance tire improvements, safety enhancing mass reduction of vehicle weight and of accessories, and it takes about two-thirds of the energy of the gas to move the vehicle. In terms of efficient engines, variable valve control engines, and direct injection burn that gets the optimum balance between air and gas, integrated starter generators, and improved transmissions up to 5 to 6 speed automatic transmissions, optimized shift schedules, and continuously variable transmissions. We can also, in B, accelerate additional efficiencies through low rolling resistant tire replacement tires, requiring, as California has already done, that all replacement tires are as efficient as the original equipment. And this will save us 6%, up to 6% on fuel efficiency. Also, ultra-low viscosity motor oils, which according to the Society of Automotive Engineers, will reduce fuel consumption by 3%. In terms of the heavy-duty trucks, we can do all of these items in A above, but we can also insert an auxiliary power unit so that when the truck is stopped at truck stops, gas stations overnight, that the driver can simply use this smaller APU to heat or cool or refrigerate the truck instead of having to run the entire vehicle. We can get some improvements in the aviation, industrial, and residential sectors, improving boiler and furnace efficiency, substituting biomass products for petrochemical feedstocks used in chemicals, plastics, solvents, pharmaceuticals. In the residential area, switching from propane or kerosene to biofuels or solar power for space and water heating. And in aviation, and I'm not talking yet about jet fuel, but we can reduce fuel consumption by up to 5% by streamlining flight planning and ground logistics. And the FAA has verified this. None of this talks about the breakthroughs that are on the horizon. And when we wrote this book, we realized that every 3 months, everything we said was going to be a little outdated because technology was moving so fast. I mean, there's trillions of dollars being invested globally in clean energy. Breakthroughs like advanced batteries that can go 200 miles on no charge, hydrogen fuel cells that can run cars and stationary power systems, biofuels from algae that can get 5 to 10,000 gallons per acre as opposed to 3 to 600 gallons per acre as soybeans does. However, in the another breakthrough, Branson, who is committed that his fleet of 100 Virgin Air jets will run eventually on biofuels, has already tested a commercial-grade biofuel. And Embraer Air in Brazil is already running propeller planes on a sugar-based ethanol for air taxis and air cargo. Next slide, please.
Dr. Brown, I just wanted to let you know that we are at the 20-minute mark.
Okay, no perfect. Thank you so much. In terms of the biofuels, we understood when we were writing the book and started even back in 2005 that there is going to be a backlash against corn because of its low net energy and because it would be competitive with food and animal feedstocks. And what we really need to look at is the trajectory that moves from corn to sugar to cellulosic. The Department of Energy says we will have up to 15 billion gallons of cellulosic, fast-growing energy grasses and trees that don't compete with food or feedstocks by 2015. And the Department of Defense projects that up to 50% of our fuel will come from biofuels by the middle of this century. That's amazing. Imagine a free Cuba, a revived Haiti, the old sugar economies of the Caribbean and Brazil, as well as new sugar producers in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, producing global energy supply with no monopoly on the biofuels. Next slide, please. Can we do this? Absolutely. How can you say absolutely? I say absolutely because we've done this all before. The U.S. last paid attention to oil prior to the 2007 time when oil almost hit $140 a barrel, back during the 70s and 80s, after the second oil shock of the Iranian Revolution, which raised oil prices even more than the 1973 Arab oil embargo. At that time, decisive congressional action imposed CAFE standards, and the U.S. showed over the next decade it could replace oil quickly and busted OPEC in the 1980s. As a Rocky Mountain Institute report said, in those 8 years, the U.S. proved, I quote, it could boost oil efficiency faster than OPEC could cut its prices. While gross domestic product rose by 27%, oil consumption fell by 17%, net imports by 50%, and net imports of oil from the Persian Gulf fell by a staggering 87%. President Reagan came in, he deregulated it, he lifted the CAFE standards, but had we maintained that pace of oil savings of about 5.2% a year, we would have already met the Gulf challenge. Next slide, please. Oh, I'm sorry, stay with this slide. In heavy-duty trucks, Walmart, the second largest corporation in the world, and the other out of the top 10, Walmart is number two. The other nine are all oil and auto companies, which show where the resistance has come from for the past 30 years. Walmart set out to achieve a 25% reduction in fuel use in 3 years. It achieved 18% improvement in 1 year alone by installing these auxiliary power units in its fleet of long-haul tractor trailers, and I believe Walmart has one of the largest, if not the largest, fleet of these tractor trailers, at about 7,100 of them in the country. Biofuels, Brazil has gone down this road starting back in the 80s when they couldn't afford to pay the oil ransom that was going over to OPEC. By the use of a simple computer chip, the vehicles recently in Brazil can run on either 100% ethanol, 100% oil, or any combination. These are called flexible fuel vehicles. Today, 70% of all new vehicles sold in Brazil are flexible fuel. It's a large part of the reason why President Lula declared Brazil energy independent last year. The U.S. has well over 500 million of these flexible fuel vehicles. So all of these things have been done before. There's nothing new involved in the Prometheus plan. It's just putting it together in a consistent way and accelerating and making the political commitment to reach this. Next slide, please. It's very important in this economy, since consumers are going to Courtney, I just lost the visuals. I'll come back. To realize, yes, great, that this Prometheus plan will also generate, either save or generate 2 million jobs. And every major study shows that more jobs are generated than in renewable energy and clean energy than in fossil fuels. The center bullet point shows 4 times more jobs per dollar invested than if we spent that money on oil. Next slide, please.
Dr. Brown, you have 5 minutes left.
Okay, very good. President Obama is on board with this and has said we cannot consign our children to this future. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. The Prometheus plan meets, please stay right there, the Gulf Challenge in terms of technological viability and energy security and energy policy by using only off-the-shelf technologies that can impact oil savings in 10 years, accelerated through sound policies like mandating state-of-the-art improvements in heavy-duty vehicles. Next slide, please. Next slide. Expanding the current renewable fuel standard to 28 billion gallons, lifting the import tax on Brazilian ethanol. And next slide, please. It meets the environmental sustainability by accelerating renewable fuel efficiencies and biofuels in the transportation sector while reducing greenhouse gas emissions and pollution. And since transportation is 33% of U.S. carbon-related emissions, this is significant. Next slide, please. It can be phased in gradually, CAFE standards 3-4% a year, biofuels 2 billion gallons additional a year. And also, I want to emphasize, it does not include these advanced technology vehicles, which are right around the corner, but which are not going to give us the levels of oil savings today that we need. When they come online, they will also help. This can all be done, according to a Rocky Mountain Institute analysis, at the cost of $180 billion over the next decade, which will save the U.S. $200 billion a year forever. Next slide, please. Next slide. The way we propose to do this, could you go back one slide, is through an excess profit tax on the $1 trillion in net cash flow from operations over the next 5 years. This is free cash flow after the oil companies have spent everything else, exploration, amortization, bonuses, $400 million package to their CEO. These are excess profits. Saudi Arabia and the other OPEC nations already tax the oil companies more heavily, and I haven't noticed any of the oil companies going bankrupt. Given the large U.S. debt, the fact that we have heavily subsidized the oil industry and oil's role in our current problem, it should be done through an excess profit tax. And just as the government is administering the BP plan, so it should administer this, because there's going to be a profit made on this investment that the government, the consumer, the transportation sector, and even the oil companies should benefit from. This is not, as some people called the BP $20 billion plan, a Chicago-style shakedown. This is a shakeup of our energy future. Next slide, please. These are the benefits of the Prometheus Plan, and I only have one more slide and we'll be done. And when you look at these benefits, including mitigating climate change, protecting the environment, and reducing pollution, half of our trade deficit is involved with oil. And in reestablishing the United States leadership in the clean energy area, we're going to help the entire world by providing that leadership. The world is waiting for that leadership. Let me close with two things. First, a quote. Since this is a July 4th Gulf Challenge, a quote from Thomas Paine, one of the founding fathers of the United States. The world is my country, all mankind are my brethren, and to do good is my religion. Next slide. These are some of the key resources, and if you'll go to the greenlaborjournal.org on Thursday, you'll see an article by me. I'm the senior editor of that journal that goes into many of these issues in depth. And the last slide, please. So, what are we waiting for? This is not only an economic, national security, and environmental issue. It is one of the pressing moral issues of our time. The beauty of nature is manifest in the beauty of humanity. Yet humanity, through technology, has shown an ability to destroy and pollute nature, now on a global scale. We must adopt the Prometheus Plan today so that humanity can once again live in harmony with Mother Nature. This is the true magnitude and calling of the Clean Energy Gulf Challenge. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brown, for your presentation, and we appreciate the audience's thoughtful questions. This has been another Southern Alliance for Clean Energy webinar and the first of our Gulf Challenge finalists. Please join us tomorrow and Thursday for the remaining finalists. Tomorrow we hear from National Energy Independence Plan and Thursday from Oceania. You can find out more information about the Clean Energy Gulf Challenge finalists, including today's complete presentation and voting instructions, along with more information on the work we do at Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. On behalf of SACE, have a wonderful afternoon. Thank you.